Welcome to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Andras Goggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Andras Goggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I'm joined by local talent, longtime friend, and our producer, Mark Turcotte. Together, we explore how incredible people, the voices of Andras Goggin, build, lead, and thrive while contributing to a better quality of life for all. Welcome. We are excited to be joined with Jess Donovan today. I have had the pleasure of knowing Jess. She was the first face that helped welcome me into the chamber. She was on the hiring committee that brought me in years ago, five years ago now. And there was an exchange in that conversation during the very first interview that focused on hospitality and tourism. And little did I know, Jess's position, her role on the board, the work she'd done in tourism and hospitality, where I challenged the notion of what tourism meant in Andras Goggin County. And that was when I realized how incredible you were. And it was also when I realized that this was an organization I wanted to be part of. So I could not be happier to have you join us today on our Build, Lead, Thrive podcast. So I'm joined by Jess Donovan. She's an established leader, an entrepreneur with over a decade of experience leading both branded and independent hotels. She co-founded Lucro Management, and I had the pleasure of watching you launch that business in the time that I've known you. Lucro is a woman-owned asset management firm that strategically helps business owners grow their top-line revenue, control their costs, and maximize profit margins, specifically in the hospitality and construction industries. She's passionate about growth. Jessica focuses on developing the potential in people, places, and spaces, including that of her hometown of Auburn, where she continues to actively support the area's economic development. Welcome to our podcast today, Jess.
Thank you so much for having me. I thought it was an easy yes, anything hospitality related to lift that up in this community. So thank you.
We'll get into this in a little bit, but I grew up in tourism. I grew up in Bar Harbor. My family's from Bar Harbor. In some ways, that is kind of an epicenter of tourism in Maine, not just from a branding perspective, but for people who live and were raised in that community. Part of how you identify is in your relationship to the tourism industry. Well, though the relationships are many, the identity is always connected to that in some way. And so we're going to start with a little getting to know you.
Are we going to sing?
Getting to know you. We've got to get a jingle. All about yeah.
That was worth it.
It's so perfect, right? Yeah. Yep.
I've been practicing for 2 weeks. Getting to Know You is a relaxed, engaging segment where we ask guests fun, personality-revealing questions to help listeners learn about and connect with our guest on a personal level.
So, Jess, what's a book, show, or movie that has inspired you recently? We accept inspirational podcasts as well.
Okay, well, I am actually in the middle of reading a book right now that is inspirational, which is traditionally, I love the murder mystery, so hopefully that would not be inspirational to many.
Ooh, but I hope not.
But right now I'm reading Walk Through Fire by Sheila Johnson, and she was a woman that made history as America's first female black billionaire. She co-founded Black Entertainment Television, and she's CEO of a hotel group and owns multiple professional sports teams.
Badass.
Yeah, so it's more of a memoir about how her institutional racism impacts affected her life and kind of the resilience from there. And so, definitely a badass. I had the opportunity to listen to her speak in person down in Arizona a couple weeks ago.
Oh.
So I had to get her book immediately, and so far it's fantastic.
Was she great to listen to?
Yes, yes. She's like 75 years old, I think. And
she's been at it for a minute.
Yep.
And slaying it.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's great.
I love stories of overcoming. And then particularly when the people who overcome are willing to share their story. Some of us have been through some stuff. And it's not always easy to retell it.
Yeah.
So I always have a lot of admiration for that. What's your favorite way to spend a weekend in Andras Goggin County? So you're a mom.
Yes.
So feel free to couch it as date night or family weekend. Totally up to you.
I mean, I like to do a little bit of both, mm-hmm. but I have found, especially this summer, and I'm not sure why, I found myself in Poland more mm-hmm. than ever. You know, I think as the dishes start to pile up and the laundry takes hold, we have a little 20-foot travel trailer that we pop on and take it out to Poland Spring Campground, and it's easy enough to commute into town, so yeah. I can work there, I can come to the office, and then I've been doing a lot of golf and pickleball out at Poland Spring golf course, so...
How's your handicap in golf?
I mean, I'm not great.
You're working
I'm
on
not
it.
Great.
You're working on it.
I have pink clubs. That's all I care about.
I would do golf all the time if golf had designated drivers and I just got to drive the golf cart. That's like all I want out of golf. What I've found is that people who are great at golf, when you're like, I'd love to learn the game, they say, great, there's pros for that.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
have no interest in teaching. I've never seen a sport where folks are more reticent to help you learn how to play it. They're like, just go to the pro shop yep. and book some time. When you get good, then you can come out with us.
Yep. They've got a women's league out there, I think, either Tuesday night.
It's huge.
I'm eventually going to get there.
Yeah, it's yet. Huge. I think you would find you'd be in good company, that half that league is at the same learning stage that you are.
It's a lot of fun.
Yep. I love Poland Spring. They always do a great job.
How's your pickleball game?
I started and showed up at a league here and had no idea what I was doing. And they were the most welcoming group here.
My point. The difference between pickleball
awesome.
And golf.
Yeah.
That's my point.
So great. And now there's courts down. Edward Little has some painted lines. So I took my girlfriends, went out Tuesday night, and we played for an hour before the sunset. And yeah, it's just really laid back, just enough exercise. And
I hear picking your pickleball paddle.
Oh.
That's a sentence I never thought
of. That is a thing.
It's like yes. super personal. There's not like, go get a paddle. It's a thing.
Yeah. No, look, I showed up with like a $20, you know, I didn't know any different. I thought, right. what's the difference? And they were so kind to me, and they're asking, so you know that, here, you hear that sound that your paddle's making? I was like, yeah, doesn't it sound cool? And it's a little hollow.
Aww.
I was like, oh, okay. And they were so wonderful. By the time I left, I think there was 15 different individuals that had offered for me to try their paddles. So I was able to pick one out of that group and go get that. It was really, it was awesome.
See?
Yeah.
That's how I think an introduction like really, to a new sport yeah. should feel.
It was
that's
a community for sure.
Yeah. I feel like Maine was slow to catch on to the pickleball game.
Yeah.
Florida was very far ahead of us. The retiree community, I think, really made some advances in pickleball. Do pickleballers pickleball in the winter?
Yes.
Like, are most of the courts
indoor,
outside? Or?
No, the Armory. Yeah, the Raymond has a group for it. Poland has a group for it. I mean, it's definitely spread through. I mean, I don't want to give out the secrets because if there's too many people show up, then
thing.
I can't play. So it's like I got to find a balance to like supporting it, but also keeping it in my back pocket so I can still play.
What's a surprising skill or talent that you have outside of work?
So here's the thing. I really genuinely, like, it's not a sense of humbleness. I really do not have a talent. Like, it's actually kind of embarrassing. I can't, like, we can go through the list together.
You don't
even,
cook,
right?
You don't bake.
Nope.
Music art.
No music art. Nope. Keep going. Keep trying me. Honestly. I asked my husband.
Are you good at pickleball? Could that be your surprising skill and talent?
I don't think so. I even asked my husband this. Oh, God, it wasn't too long ago. And I said, you know, if I had to identify like a skill or talent outside of work, what would it be? He's like, I mean, you nag well. Like, does that count?
Oh, I mean, it gets you places.
It does. Because I was like, so I did tell him, I'm like, so does that mean either I'm really good at follow-up or I get things done? Because it could be either of that. Yeah.
They're related.
Yeah. I promised myself I was going to learn another language. We even hosted an exchange student from Spain. My husband speaks fluent Spanish. So I thought for sure, I was like, this is my chance. And I
nothing
still didn't get there. So my task is to find a talent or skill outside of work. I get it.
Maybe your skill is being really good at a lot of things without being great.
And that could be it.
I feel like that is a goal. I think lots of people, you don't need to be, what is it, the master?
Jack of all trades, yeah. master of
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bringing my dad into the room there. I appreciated that. Shout out to Vernon. When you love what you do, and it's true because I work significant hours, but when you love what you do, it does become inextricably linked and it's hard to parse out. This was a work moment and this was a...
Absolutely.
I love my family and sometimes that feels like work, so... With love. If you're full-time parenting, you know what I mean. It's not a bad thing. It just, work is labor, right?
Very true.
You don't raise a family without putting in some labor. What is your biggest professional influence to date?
It's people, honestly. I mean, I think that I'm in the business of people. And so I have, I mean, four individuals that have shaped, I think, who I am in my career path right now. Danny Lafayette with Lafayette Hotel Group was really the first person that identified opportunity for me at a young age and gave me the opportunity, I think it was 22 years old, to run a 100-room hotel with food and beverage. I had no idea what I was doing. Kind of learned, he let me learn on the fly in that space, and I learned the foundational expectations of what a customer might want. So, you know, it doesn't have to be brand new and fancy, but it has to be clean and in good working order. And then from there, a gentleman named Henry Sirwa, which if there's some local listeners, will know that gentleman's name real well.
I got to work with a family member of his for years.
Oh, he is just Nancy. Amazing. Yes, Nancy. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know Nancy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a small world.
Oh, it is. It is. He challenged me in a different way, but he allowed me to learn the tangibles of the business. So, you know, I think having the opportunity so young to grow into the leadership role, I didn't have time to watch and learn from other mentors. And so I was reliant on the group that was around me, and they supported me wholeheartedly, even at that young age, and stood by me. But I didn't feel like I could give back to them what they deserved in those roles, because I didn't know, again, what I was doing. So learning from Henry, I really had the opportunity to see what it should feel like and be like, and how we take care of the customer and the people. That was a life-changing moment, I think, when I made the decision to leave my role as general manager at 26 years old and step what I felt like falling off a ladder, you know, jumping off a ladder, not just a rung down, really just getting off the ladder completely and starting over, it felt like, or giving up. But it allowed me to come back to my hometown and work here at our property in Auburn at the front desk. And at one point I was like, man, I don't know if I'll ever get back to where I was at such a young age, but I'm so grateful for that decision and that fear-based decision-making to do that. The last big real influence is more on a national level. I follow Kat Cole. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. Her first name's K-A-T. But she is a seasoned executive leader doing global brands. But she has a really humble beginning, more of a self-made individual. And I've always identified with some of her core beliefs. And we talk about hustle muscle and saying yes in the moment and then doing the work to figure out how to balance the gaps there afterwards. Like, I think that's like a telltale sign of anybody that starts a business, even at that point, is you should figure it out kind of as you go. And learning from her a little bit of the balance act, you know, being a mom and, and having a family of everything you say yes to, you know, you're effectively saying no to something else. And so if I'm saying yes to an after dinner experience or networking, which is so important, I'm saying no to helping my daughter with her math homework that night. And so figuring out that balance, I think she's been a great leader in that space that can help you kind of compartmentalize some of those processes.
Yeah, that's such a real challenge. I think so often I have conversations with people about work-life balance, and I always just like to start with like, achieving balance is BS. Can we just bust the myth that there is such a thing as striking a balance? A, like it's something you achieved, right? Like that's like me saying, I'm a healthy eater and I have done that, so now I don't need to anymore and still get to say I'm a healthy eater. Like, no, it is a practice at which you are always working at every day. And some days you're awesome at it and some days you're not. And both of those will inform the next day. And so I think for me, when I talk about balance in terms of how I make sense of it to my almost adult children, some of them are adult children now, and to my peers and even to my staff and how we think about work-life balance here in terms of organizational culture, balance is something you achieve on a longer time horizon. So if you're looking at like, how did I do at balancing these things over the course of a year, all of a sudden you can find that balance or the inequity within it. But if you're trying to get balance, you know, quote unquote, on an 8-hour day or on a 7-day work week, like, good luck. You're just going to beat yourself up all the time. So it's not a box that you're like, yeah, I got balance. I did that. It's just not a real thing. And I've seen you navigate that in the years that I've known you with grace and skill.
Thank you. Yeah. It's an endless learning curve, I think, for all of us. So
yeah. No, I love that. That's so great. I hope everybody knows you a little bit better out of that. I think when you talk about leadership, it actually got me thinking that you, maybe that could have been the skill that you couldn't self-recognize. And I've always noted that people, true leaders, seldom recognize themselves as leaders. So I'm going to give that gift back to you.
Well, thank you.
I would say to you, leadership is one of your skills that might be surprising. And I have seen it outside of work as well as inside.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll take that to heart, and I will remember that the next time somebody asks me. I will blame you. So
you need to go home and tell your husband. Yeah. I've replaced nag with leader. Yeah. I think many people would find them somewhat interchangeable. Yeah. And so perhaps I've given you both a gift today. I love it. Because that feels pretty relatable.
I love it.
Yeah. I want to tap into your background and experience a little bit. I love in your bio that we talk, and you've already talked a lot about hospitality, but you have expanded beyond the hospitality industry. And your rich experience in hospitality, lodging, property management, as you just noted, started at a really young age.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you share a bit about how you got started and what shaped your journey in these industries so far? You talked about jumping off the ladder. That's a choice point. Unless someone pushed you really hard. Maybe that's part of what you need to share.
Yeah.
But how did you get here? How did you end up being a business owner and multiple business owners? Don't let that slip by.
You know, and I think I'm still trying to figure out that part of it, that part of the timeline. How did that happen?
Yeah.
But really, you know, and I think this is so true for so many people in the hospitality industry, and I don't think we talk about it enough, but it's a place that you don't necessarily need to go and do a four-year degree and do all the levels of that. And so it can be a great path for a lot of people in a career. And in so many ways, people fall into it. And we always joke that if you're in it for 2 years, you probably aren't getting out, or you'll find yourself back in there again.
Yeah.
And so for me, I was going to school full-time. I was in college full-time down in the University of Southern Maine, and also working full-time. I graduated in 2008. So I was going to school for criminology. I thought for sure I was going to be a forensic detective.
I did a little skeeving around on the internet and found that you had a criminology degree.
Yes.
And I was like, where are we fitting that in, Jess? How does that make sense?
Well, boy, you guys would be surprised how overlapping those two are, unfortunately.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had done a study abroad in Sweden. This was definitely my path. I looked at my first two real-life photographs related to the forensics, and that was not CSI or Law and Order I had come to know. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's too late now. I'm 3.5-4 years into my degree.
Yeah.
Finish it up. And so coincidentally, it was also 2008. So we had the great
recession
happening. And so there was, you know, no jobs to be had that's going to offset my college student loans that are going to be kicking in. And I happened to be working at the hotel with the Lafayette Group. And I just kind of wasn't sure what I was going to do and kept working day in and day out. And then 2 years in, Danny had offered me the position of GM, and I didn't look back, I guess. I didn't explore anything else. I loved working with the people. You know, at that point, I was working with primarily truck drivers were the base clientele. So I think I got some thick skin on how to deal with customers. I love truck drivers, by the way. There's no judgment there by any means. They're some of the best, most fun customers to have because you hear all their road stories. From there, blossomed, I think, at some point in my career path, and I would say probably over the last decade or so, it became more about the people that I was working with and not the people we were serving. And I remember having some real in-depth self-reflection of like, am I still in the right space if I don't necessarily prioritize the customer experience anymore? Like, that didn't matter to me as much. It mattered whether the person that, you know, shows up for their 7-to-3 shift had dinner on their table that night and their kids had a place to sleep. And so there was some shifts going on there. And I think then COVID really impacted. I was still a GM at that point. We had just started Lucro at the end of 2019. Our contract started January 1st of 2020. So I was like, who starts a business in hospitality that is fully funded off of tourism and the one industry that completely shut down? So we got ourselves, you know, now we're responsible for a multi-million dollar business operation and our own business at the same time. And so we found ways to navigate that. And it was all about the people that were there by our side during that time. So
I would say this, and maybe this is how you can help reconcile it too, but when you take care of the people you work with, of whom it is their job to take care of the customer, that's how you're taking care of the customer. That's how you're putting the customer first. If you have people who aren't able to show up at work whole and seen as whole and valued and given the space and resources and empowerment to do their job well, it doesn't matter how many checklists you have or how refined you have made the expectation of that staff person to provide XYZ service at what quality. If they can't do it, they're not gonna. So taking care of the people, just remember, taking care of the people is how you take care of your customer.
Yeah. And that was the most enjoyable part for me.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I finally connected to what it was. And I think as we get so far removed from the customer in spaces like this, it can be challenging. But the staff, the team, they know best. And so it was really fun leaning on them to, you know, I think I learned so much from the whole team in that space.
Have you ever worked in the nonprofit sector? You haven't, right?
I have not.
Yeah. I mean, you spent some time with us on our board. Yep. Thank you so much. Appreciated your years of service. Yes. So the reason I mention that is there's an interesting thing that happens parallel. And this is the first time I've really heard someone articulate it as clearly as you just did from the for-profit sector, which is so valuable. But when folks work in the nonprofit sector, likewise, the kind of career development is coming in at an entry level. Entry level tends to mean part of direct service in nonprofit, depending on what resource or what mission, or, you know, it might be leading the trail discussions for an outdoor recreation nonprofit. It could be being a direct support professional in a healthcare nonprofit. But likewise, they come in at the entry level, and then folks who, like you, probably spent 2 years or more are in for life, right? And then and they see their own career trajectory increase. But the further you rise in the career, the further you tend to be, by definition, from the person of whom your mission is meant to impact. Mm. And that same challenge is something I've heard over and over again from the nonprofits that we work with and partner with and support. It is so helpful to hear someone else describe it in such a succinct way. Sorry to make that longer, because mine's probably not succinct, but that was exactly, I mean, it's the first time I've ever heard that parallel pathway so well summarized. That's just such an interesting thing. So with your deep involvement in the local hospitality scene, and, you know, for the sake of our listeners, what's local mean in this conversation? You're doing work not just here.
We're kind of a little bit all over the place right at the moment. It feels like we're in a pivotal space with Lucro in general. You know, we were managing the Hilton Garden Inn here in Auburn. We were partnered for about 5 years with Lucro, 10 years total on a personal level. So I have a deep connection to the people in the property there. And the owner that we were working with just sold that back in May. So we're no longer actually affiliated there. The new ownership group is out of Mass, and they own and operate a ton of their own properties. But that's not to say that the people that are still there are very, very local to us. They are our neighbors.
Yeah.
And so they went through a pretty hefty transition there over the summer, and they did a fantastic job. The leader over there is just amazing, Kayla. Right now, we've been doing a lot of more consulting. You know, we're in budget season, and so there's a lot of independent properties here in the state that they are too busy running their property to do all of the financials and all of the things.
Analysis. People don't understand. Like, hard. You can push print on your P&L and you can pay your bills, but being able to understand what those numbers mean and then figure out what strategies you might put in place, because that's your sweet spot.
I love that.
That's
work.
You excel at that work.
All, you know, the industry is data driven anyway, but using all of that data to really strategize, not just what's happened, but what does the future look like in a pretty tumultuous environment, you know, with all the politics and everything going on, that things could go in multiple directions. So we spent a lot of time in that space, and we have branched out and find ourselves supporting the construction industry more and more. My husband and I have a construction company that builds new homes, very much needed in this area specifically.
Keep going. Build them,
super
please.
Excited. We've got a development in the works for Lewiston and in Auburn right now.
That's great.
And I think small houses underway, you know, Capes, Colonials, and Ranches. Very basic.
We just
basic,
don't have that inventory.
We do not. Yeah. We're working on that. And so we're doing all of the asset management for that work. But what we found through that is that I've always had a soft spot for the trades anyway.
Yeah.
In the trades, you know, these people are so skilled in the actual work they do, but the management side of it, the business management side, I mean, that's, you have to go to school for that, completely different.
Yeah.
And so how can you expect a finished carpenter to know exactly how to run their business and protect their liabilities? That's the biggest one. Yeah. What type of insurances do you need? If you have employees, what are the labor laws look like? You don't have time when you're working in the business. So we've been able to support a lot of our subcontractors through that lens as well recently. It's been a lot of fun learning some of, you know, there's a lot of overlap, that construction mm-hmm. and hospitality really support one another in a lot of ways. So
I think people would be surprised. And locally, so we, you know, we work with a lot of hospitality-based businesses, lodging, restaurants, food service, bars within the chamber. And there's a group that we convene every month called Connecting Over Hospitality. And it's one of my favorite, one of my favorite it's monthly moments. Yeah, they're just super raw. If you've ever, there's so much kinness between lodging and restaurants and bars. And oftentimes a lodging facility will have all of those facilities kind of wrapped up in one. But if you've ever worked with a chef, the colorful language there, that's like, this is my version of truckers and my version of hospitality for what that's worth. And I also say it with absolute love. I grew up in hospitality myself, like started bussing tables and worked my way through the industry and the front of house, back of house divide. But I am also a blue collar daughter. I'm like a third generation electrician's daughter. And then I have an electrician son as well now. And his father's an electrician. I have a roofer at home. And so there is so much overlap. And what I always like in our connecting over calls that people talk about is that part of the lifeblood of our local hospitality sector is a lot of the trades. Being the bed vacancy, you know, the booked beds in our region tends, there's a big relationship there, not just similarities, but beds are booked by, and many of our lodging institutions are receiving consistent, like it is the less tumultuous part of our local hospitality. And so it's interesting how that has come to such a nexus point for you.
Yeah. It's been enjoyable learning about it.
Yeah. I love tradespeople. I just love a good, real conversation with, and so, you know, the like takes 10,000 hours to master a craft, right? Like I'm maybe at 8,000 on spreadsheets and nobody cares like what a spreadsheet looks like in your home. But like to see somebody who can come in and do a mitered corner, for example, on some finished trim, for example, of which I am awful at and do not want to see my handiwork, but like you can really appreciate somebody who is a master at their craft. And how also, in the same way that I can't do that, they probably don't want to spend a ton of time in analyzing data and spreadsheets.
Correct, right. And who I'm can blame them at that point? Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's super, super real. What do you think that we're doing well in our community, in our region, when it comes to welcoming visitors and providing lodging? And what are some of the bigger opportunities that exist in this region? And let me set the scene for you. We're in a boardroom at Central Maine Community College in September of 2019. And a younger version of me challenges you that we don't have a tourism industry. We have a hospitality industry, but we don't have a tourism industry. And some of that is, you know, we don't have the lighthouses, we don't have the lobster, we don't have this shout out to Lost Valley Ski, but we don't have Sugarloaf in our backyard. Thank God we have Lost Valley. What are we doing well when it comes to hospitality, and what's our potential? What's our opportunity?
It's a little bit of a loaded question with lots of different directions. Like,
oh yeah, fight
that.
Me on it. Yeah. That's why, like, I mean, I want the most real. You schooled me in the room that day, and we've worked together to find middle ground on the hospitality versus tourism thinking. And to full transparency, we do a lot to attract tourists as well as population. So I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, no, and I would say more so under your leadership here with the current structure of the chamber, the work is being done in the right direction, you know. And I think from advantages aspect, it's the people, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, the people that are here, there are people in this hospitality network that could be down in Boston. They can really be elevated in different communities, but they choose to stay here. You know, we should be asking them too, why here? Because there are some really great professionals in and around our spaces. And so, you know, we're somehow attracting the right people in that way. You know, the natural resources, I think we've done a better job highlighting mm-hmm. than, you know, even the work around the falls, the, you know, Mount Appetite, Thorn Creek, all of those areas. Our self-image is still the critical turning point, in my opinion. You know, we're our own worst enemy in that.
Yeah.
And when someone asks, you know, where do you like to go? What do you like to do? You know, the comments that you see online and stuff, they trend more negative, and it's mm-hmm. from our own people. And I will tell you, from my experience, it is not the guest travelers coming in. They are not saying those things. And so it's really unfortunate to hear ourselves speaking that way about our own community, because the outsiders, they fall in love with the, when they drive into this town and they see the downtown areas, they see Lisbon Street, they see the downtown, the bridge and the falls. I mean, it's eye opening. Then they go sit down at a local restaurant, and we have a lot of local restaurants, right? You know, not so much the chains for them. They rave about it. And so I would love to find a way to turn that narrative around, but I know we've been working on that for several years.
You've been working on it sooner than I was.
Gosh, yeah, yeah. That's a lot. For me, the cost of labor in our market is actually less than a lot of the other areas. You know, you look at Portland's situation that they have during emergencies. The contract labor that took place nationally was up 400% over the year prior because we couldn't find the people to work.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, in 21 and 22, we had our first real challenges here in this market with labor and workforce. And that's trending, you know, the great stay versus the great resignation.
Yeah.
We're seeing that the great stay starting to take hold a little bit, and people are starting to settle in and not feel that they're going to jump, you know, down the road for a dollar or two more. So I think, you know, there's some opportunity there to retrain some of our folks, because we brought people in that did not have the training behind them to do the job well. And it is a demanding job when you're customer facing. And so they get burned out fast. And we didn't have the time or resources during COVID and 21 and 22 and honestly into 23 to get them the resources they needed. So I think that we've almost gone through this reset in 2024 a little bit. You know, multiple properties in this market have been either purchased or have joined partnerships with other ownership groups. Mm. So
we've lost some properties. We've lost some properties in the inventory in this market.
And that, you know, that one in particular is a huge disadvantage for us.
Yeah, we've felt that. Here at the Chamber, we've felt that. Our members have felt that as they try to plan events or conferences. I'm part of a couple of statewide and national groups, and it makes it challenging for us. You know, it's not uncommon that I get can you put out an RFP to your members for a 500 person conference? And I say, no, I can't.
It's painful.
Yeah, it hurts. Yeah. It hurts. And the economic impact and fallout of that, it's a ripple effect.
And
right?
It's long term. And I think, you know, it's a little twofold. You know, it's going to be really hard to measure the impacts of that alone, the inability to capture the group business that we need in our market to not just sustain our hotels, but like you said, I mean, these people go out to have dinners and they go to
catch a show, take in a comedy show. Yeah.
Play. Yeah. And so that measured with, unfortunately, the mass shooting, we know statistically that there's a downturn in tourism after that. And so you put those two pieces of the pie together, that could be catastrophic. And nobody can measure that currently, you know? Yeah. And I think that's one of my bigger fears right now is we're in a stagnant market. We have not had new hotel rooms since, I think it was 2017 was probably the last.
Was it Hampton?
Yeah, Hampton would have been the last. Yeah. You know, when you look at overall numbers, by far, there should be another property built even before the Ramada turned over. The numbers show that it's reasonable for a developer to want to develop here. But then you start looking at the cost of construction, the costs of the interest rates. I mean, the high interest rates was a burden in and of itself.
Yeah.
And so that stagnancy in a market, you know, it also contributes a little bit high risk for someone else looking in when they're seeing, you know, we're struggling in other areas that might be closing or turning over. And so there's a lot of aging infrastructure of the current properties. The cost of renovations is extremely high. Thankfully, because I think it's the right thing. The hotel brands are really now coming back and saying, okay, we gave you guys some leeway during COVID, and now we need to bring our brands and our experience for our guests back to expectations, because we've limited services, right? Yeah. We took away daily cleaning for a while. We took away a lot of amenities, but we charged more. You paid a lot, $400 a night for a hotel room with way less services. Of course, the customer deserves better. So, you know, they're pushing that, but that all comes at a cost to owners. And I think there's a lot of people that don't understand a branded hotel is a local owner 9 times out of 10.
So many people don't. I wouldn't have understood that until I started knowing the people who do own our local hotels and that their kid goes to school with my kid. And like, I mean, it's very, I think oftentimes we think of corporate
Correct.
And corporate brands and make some big assumptions about, like, you know, the corporate showing up and they're real people.
Absolutely.
They're just real people, real business owners.
And that's all it is. They're paying the overhead, the price tag, and it is exorbitant to fly that flag, to buy into the loyalty rewards points that customer brings with them when they come. Yeah. That is all it is. But all of the other, everything else is strictly local and makes it hard. The margins are shrinking more and more every day.
I'm just curious when I think about the realities that you just named, right? So we're facing a local market that has some restrictions on it for adding to the inventory. We see the impact of that to being able to attract conferences here when we have big events, whether that big event is a graduation weekend or a Dempsey Challenge, right? Or a balloon festival. We see the limitations of that to the draw that we're trying to do. And sometimes I don't think people realize, like, so sorry, listener, that it's hard for you to get a room. Mm-hmm. And we get that. It is hard for the balloon pilot to get the room that makes the balloon festival work. That is the reason you don't have a room. And boy, we even have less if the balloon pilot doesn't have a room. And that plays in so many other ways that, like, very key vendors are needed to be able to also find rooms. And so we see a limited inventory. We see a stagnant market, as you put name to. What does it look like for us to think creatively? And I know some other communities have done this, some, like, you know, sister communities to Lewiston and Auburn, Milltown communities that are going through a revival. Does it need to be new construction? Can we do a scalable boutique hotel in a mill?
I love
Do you have a vision
mills.
Board around it already?
I mean, I have it here in my notes, boutique mill hotel. Yeah. I absolutely have that right in front of me. Yeah, but, you know, I think, and that's something, you know, I would love to find somebody that would be interested in doing that work, because I think we could bring a really helping hand to working through that idea of it first, because I'm sure there's got to be codes and issues with safety and the cost of bringing these old mills into that kind of space to meet the state and local regulations. But I love boutique properties, and, you know, there is a market here for that. They've been very staying.
Is boutique by size or by structure or something else?
It's a little bit of both. You know, I think when I think of boutique, and everybody does think about it a little bit different, but I think of it generally 50 rooms or less, usually in that 30 to 50 room sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And to me, it tells a story. So it's very curated to the customer experience. So when they go there, they're learning something about either the area or, you know.
It's experience, not a bed.
Correct. And that's the trend right now. It's been the trend for a while. It's experience-based travel.
It's what I pick.
Absolutely.
When I go anywhere, it's what my kids want to see us do too. It's interesting. So, you know, an invitation for folks to reach out to Jess and help us get our next boutique hotel in the area.
Great.
But we, in a way in which our market is currently stagnant, right, for new beds, new lodging of the hospitality sector, we're seeing this really interesting, which you're also noting with your other business, this really interesting growth in new builds and renovations of mill space in the pipeline for permits that have been cleared for developments. And we're seeing, you know, 30, 44 unit multifamilies that are definitely, you know, they're private owned. They won't be subsidized. They're somewhere between market rate and luxury. Everyone has a dishwasher, right? Like there's a quality and standard there that I think that type of housing, and it's not just the housing class customer, but it is the type of housing that we've never really seen here. I think for a long time, in terms of how we thought about bed space in our community, it's single family homes. And it's multifamilies out of necessity, and people stay in a multifamily on their pathway to a single family home. That's like just how we thought about it for so long here. I grew up in a rural community, and that was certainly the notion of what multifamilies looked like, or development. Yeah. Like where I grew up, development was such a dirty word, right? In terms of bringing that, well, there's a development coming to community where I grew up. That was bad, right? And now I spend most of my time working for that particular endeavor. I might have a grandparent rolling in the grave, who knows? But we've seen, you know, we see the lofts at Bates Mills started a number of years ago, which, you know, different footprint, but same general premise. You're reusing this mill space, adding some of the plumbing and sewer infrastructure, electrical infrastructure, to have multiple people getting space that they can sleep and live, even short stays, long stays inside this. The Continental Mill, which is the really big, if anyone ever Google Maps it, that's how you can get a sense of what that mill actually looks like. Continental Mill right there by the Peace Green Bridge in to New Auburn. that's going to have like 380 units by the time it's done. And I think of that as such a comparable. So seeing how they do that and what coming into compliance looks like, that's a multi-use. So when I think about like the kind of hotel that I want to go visit, it's got a bar, it's got a restaurant, right. It's got a little retail shop where I can get my umbrella because of course I forgot it again. But that mill, I think watching that mill, watching mm-hmm. their margins, watching right. what that looks like is a really good example because it will have commercial spaces. It will, you know, it's right across from an arts and culture attraction site, which is the Franco Center. And so it's just interesting that there's so much development for beds for stays, but they're these kind of like, you know, midterm, mm-hmm. mid-range, and we're not seeing them in lodging. And I can tell you firsthand, as somebody who I moved here and didn't have a soul that I was related to in this community, and now that I live here, particularly on like, oh, convenient weekends like the Balloon Festival, shout out to my family, all of a sudden you have guests. And they want to stay, and there aren't hotels to put them in, and so they're in your house.
that's real life experience.
Right. Even. And yeah. So like, yay, please come visit family and others. But what sense do you make of that? Is it a lag in the lodging industry behind residential and commercial scale residential?
For me, it's the seasonality of the business here. And, you know, we, like you said, we have Lost Valley, right? We're super heavy corporate business here, which is wonderful. You know, I love the corporate markets, but after COVID with so much remote work, there's a serious decline in the corporate sector of business in the local market. Even putting in an elevator in one of the, you have to choose, are you going to put an elevator or send your kid to college? I mean, the costs are crazy.
80 to 120.
Yeah. And so when you're looking to do an ROI, you know, on the rates that you can net in the winter time to offset your overhead in the cost of development, like there's, your margins are tricky.
Yeah.
So I think that that's an area that it's the seasonality for me. If we could say we run the figures all year round at what we run in the summer, there'd be no question about it. But it's that the cash flow issue come the wintertime for these operations of how do they stay sustainable and have that kind of construction overhead to pay back at the same time.
Yeah. See, that's why I just want to double down on exploring renovation and seeing if we can get the cost down. Right?
That's why we started a construction company.
Yeah, so good work. Can. Good work.
Yes, thank you.
So start building lodging. Can you get us a conference facility?
Yes,
go home, talk to your husband, say, we're doing it now. We had this conversation. It's got to happen. No, that makes exactly the right sense. So we've talked about some of the limitations and some of what's happening in the market and what the struggle is. If you could paint a picture for us of the vision of what it looks like for us to achieve our potential, what is the hospitality and lodging landscape? What could it look like? And what do you think it would take for us to get there? Yeah, there's no wrong answer.
I'm like, all the answers over here.
Dream big, right? Like if you could wave the magic wand, and part of it might be we're a community that appreciates ourselves more and talks about ourselves more positively, right?
I mean, like it has to be a launching point. It has to be.
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if we could get ourselves to what you're speaking of, would that change our self-image?
Yeah.
You know, is it the chicken and the egg? I don't know.
Yeah.
But for me, we need to have some kind of a convention center in some way. You know, we were already limited in the types of events we could take, even with the Ramada in the game. You know, lots of the conferences need breakout spaces.
Yeah.
There was none of that really available to us. And so all of that base would go down to the Portland market.
Yeah.
And now, you know,
or the Civic Center.
The Civic Center. Mm-hmm. Right. And so if we could compete on that type of level, the development would follow. But I don't think that development's really going to change much, in my opinion. We could see a boutique or two pop up that would make a ton of sense. But I don't foresee us seeing too much change until we figure out the housing situation. If I was developing a hotel, I want to be in a market that I know I have a workforce.
Yeah.
And right now I would be really nervous about that.
They are.
Yeah.
So the reason I asked that, and part of what I think that you're alluding to, is like we have a historic, we have not seen as many units of housing, and I'm talking townhouses, single family and subdivisions, multifamily, higher end multifamily, rentals, luxury rentals, condos, like all, there's so many. I think for a long time, this region thought about homes as like, you have a single family, maybe you have a duplex or a triple decker, which we're very much known for and is very very familiar in other communities that had the Franco immigration. There's a lot of connections to us and other mill towns that reflect that in the housing and the history of the housing. But for a long time, it was like a multifamily. And even those were pretty small. Like we had, you know, maybe you had 2 4-unit stacks next to each other. And so you had like an 8-unit and that was big. But like for development, for housing, for a long time, it was pretty small. Or it was a single family homeownership structure. And now we have a historic amount of total units, variety of units, price points of units, target customer for units, everything from, you know, the professionals that we're talking about, particularly healthcare. We have a big healthcare sector here. Yep. You've seen our need for professionals to live in this community, whether they're traveling healthcare professionals or folks who are looking to put in a 3 or 4 year residency. You know, you see that need in the pipeline. Ground is broken. We're starting to turn keys. That has been a kind of a bolus coming at us for the last 2 or 3 years. They were already starting to teeter around the edges, and then housing became such a demand with COVID. I think it accelerated, even with the high cost of interest rates, even with the high cost of labor. That was like a double-sided, you know, coin that was just killing us at that time. And now the housing's being built. People are starting to move into the housing. We're going to have, and I'm not worried at all about having excess inventory. There's not too much in the pipeline. There's so much opportunity for Maine and for our region in general. So what if we get the housing? What if the first thing that is keeping you from the big vision that you could have is the housing? And what if 2 years from now we've got it? What then?
Then I think we'll see the development. I think we will see investors come in and put hotels down. I mean, again, the numbers are there. For us being a tertiary market to Portland, we know it is high risk in that way, but we have some huge anchors. If you think about our manufacturing base and our 2 hospitals and Bates College, I mean, that alone is a huge base for business coming in. And so you start finding ways to add to our local arts, you know, the more of the attraction base. Like, you were not wrong in 2019 when you said that to me. It just hurt my feelings a little bit. Because I don't share that same self-image of our area. And so for me, anybody that talks about it in any kind of negative way, and yours was not negative, but anything that tells me that we're not the best, like, hurts a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, finding ways to enhance that. But I think that will come, right? Like, I think that will follow suit because people will want to be here. You know, if there's houses and relatives, I would, you know, the last 2 houses we've built. One was a husband and wife that moved up from Massachusetts that wanted to be close to their family. Well, their family lives in Portland. They don't want to be in Portland. They wanted to be outside of it. And so they came here.
Yeah.
The other one was a gentleman out in Poland that's been renting out there. He wanted to be in town. So like there's desire to be here. And there's people living in places right now that they don't want to be in there. They want to have a house, right? We have to find ways to get them into that. But these people are just coming from the outside in. And so people want to be here. We just need to figure, we need to share the story more too, that people know that that is happening.
Yeah. I think that's right. And it's, you know, our last episode was our new employee, Sam, who chose Lewiston and Auburn 14 months ago from the UK.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, her wife lives in Maine and has some experience in Maine, but when they were picking where to live, they chose here. And I think there are so many people here who are like, why would you choose here? And they throw around some of the language and labels that I don't really love. And what they don't realize is how many people already have, continue to bristle, like you're second guessing their intellect or their desire to have chosen this place as home. Like that's like, why did you choose that shirt today? Now you've bad taste. Like, and you invested your money and paid taxes every, there are so many people. It is a story that we're trying to lift up because there are so many people who choose here. And you know, go full circle to the author that you're reading who's inspiring you right now is part of what I hear people say to me, and it is people of all races and classes who do say it, that they love that we have such a rich amount of culture, diversity, languages, backgrounds, and races. And for somebody who is used to being in a very multicultural, multiracial community or region, and when you think about like DC, you think about some of the metro areas that we're attracting people from who are choosing Maine because, they love outdoor recreation. Yeah, you can go to Lost Valley and you can ski or tube on the weekend. You can go put in a whole weekend at Sugarloaf. You can make it to the oceans or the lakes in the summer. We've got lower cost of, like, they love this as a nexus for all of that. And they love that there's 2 theaters. And they love that there's music options and they love the diversity of food, but they wouldn't do that if all of that meant they were looking around at a homogenous community. Right. And in Maine, we have some of the youngest population, some of the most diverse population, diverse by so many markers of culture, of food, of tradition, of faith. And for so many people, that is the selling point that I can raise my kids in a community that it more mirrors the reality of the world in which they're going to live and work. As a parent, I know that was a fundamental choice in some of my parenting choices that I made over and over again many times, right? And so when I think about that and what that adds to this community, I wish we could find a better way to talk about ourselves differently, think about ourselves differently. We do have tourism. I do love this community. You must know by now. You must know by now that was a little bit of a straw man in that interview that day.
Oh, no.
There's so much to talk about positively about this community. And I think even when I choose to go on a vacation somewhere, you know what I mean? Like, I care about the people and experiences in that community that I'm going to go visit. And there are lots of reasons to come here for a weekend. Like, is somebody going to plan a 10-day trip to Lewiston and Auburn and leave wondering if they saw it all? Maybe not.
Right.
Maybe not.
But do you know how many people, like, I wish I had the actual, I don't have the statistic in front of me, but we do track, you know, how many people stay here on their way to Bar Harbor, right?
It's huge.
People definitely do 10-day trips there, and this is where they stay on their way there. And I just don't.
I want their 2 days, even if it's the return from Bar Harbor, and their 2 days on the way up to Bar Harbor was spent in Booth Bay or Camden or whatever. Come check us out on the way back. And I think when we've been talking about what I tend to take, as you have learned over the years, I tend to take an asset-based approach. What are our strengths? How do we build on them? How do we leverage them? Not just where are we lacking or what's our deficit? And we have so many very strong assets to build on, whether it's the outdoor recreation, it's the trails, it's the public art, the number of murals, the cultural experiences. We have a really strong local food movement. And for a lot of people, when they're planning their trip, they're looking at, where can I access locally owned places? Are they featuring local food? How do I know are my ingredients? Like, there is a whole segment of people. That's an important thing to consider in terms of, like, how, where you're going and how you approach your trip aligns with your values. And we're killing it here on so many of those markers, of which we, the chamber, are actively engaged in shouting those from the mountaintops, but we don't always have a lot of other people shouting them with us. And we certainly regionally do a poor job at having shared messaging.
Yeah. And I that starts even at the state level, right?
Yeah.
Lewis and Auburn in this area.
Lakes and Mountains.
Is in the Lakes and Mountains region.
Where's the lake? Where's the mountain?
Yes. Show me. So when you start, we don't fit in that picture, right? And so when the state's doing their efforts to market and stuff, it's a little disjointed.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, and I love our was it 8 tourism districts in Maine do not ally with municipal boundaries, necessarily.
Correct.
County boundaries, not with economic, like if you go to DECD or DEOL in DOL in Maine, the districts that they lay out for Maine, by which they like measure, allocate funding, allocate in any of those different, none of them overlay. I've spent years trying to get the maps to line up. Right. They don't. They just don't. No, and luckily we've got really great staff over at ABCOG that represents the Lakes and Mountains region, and they do a good job trying to pull Lewiston and Auburn into what does feel a very disjointed kind of marketing message for them. And I appreciate that care, but it is really hard, and it does stem from kind of the way the state. Like, we're not the ocean. We aren't coastal Maine or mid-coast Maine, or let's carve out our own, Jess. Let's advocate for a 9th district and like cultural enrichment district. Yeah. Yeah. It does start to, it feels appropriate. There's something to that that resonates with me. I've appreciated this. We tend to close our show with a little segment we call Looking Back and Leading Forward.
Looking Back, Leading Forward, a reflective closing where we invite our guests to share advice or insights they would give to their younger self or to those with big ambitions in business or community leadership.
So Jess, if you could offer advice to your younger self, and if I remember all of your age markers in your story, 21-year-old Jess,
Okay.
Right before you started taking leaps and going, what would you tell yourself? What would your advice be?
I think I would tell myself not to be so concrete in my journey path and trying to establish what that direction looked like. I think I am a planner at heart, and so I need to have everything laid out in front of me as far in the future as I can.
You can stop thinking about it. You are. You can amend that to say, I know, and just move confidently with who you are and know it in your soul.
Oh, yeah. So I would say, you know, I've learned over time that growth is not linear, and there's, you know, whether there's intentionality behind it or not, I don't need to have it all planned out so far in my future, because I think that that can limit some opportunities that come up along the way.
Yeah.
And create a high level of anxiety and stress. That's unnecessary.
Not yeah. I hope she hears you, younger version of Jess. What is one lesson or piece of wisdom that you would share with someone aiming to make an impact?
For me, it would be being flexible with your understanding of what impact is, who it is for, and how it's being delivered. Because I think that's a big word, and I think it's scary for a lot of people, especially people that truly set out on that path to make an impact. And how do you measure your results? And you can feel failure way too easily. And so for me, it's really making those tiny movements really independently. You know, for example, it was kind of silly and a little bit embarrassing. For me, impact, I'll give you an example. Several years ago, I made the intentional decision that anytime I went to the grocery store and I parked my car, when I came out and unloaded my groceries, if my car was closer to the store, meaning if I had to walk away from the store to put my grocery cart away, because I'll park and maybe three spots over away from the store is the cart receptacle, then I made the conscious effort that I would turn around and go to the store, because I couldn't rationalize in my head, why am I walking away from the store and making someone else come out and come get this cart, right? And so to me, I felt like I was making an impact on one human that would have one less cart to have to carry back. And so for me, it's just like those tiniest little things. And I try to pick little things, and I engage my family and my daughter with them. And so even to this day, she's like, Mom, there's a spot right here. If you park here, then we won't have to walk all the way back to the store. I'm like, oh, you do get this.
Yeah,
good job.
She's paying attention. Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah, I think that's such a great point, because impact really, people can be really overwhelmed with what impact means. And I think there's this innate desire to have an impact. I think all of us are born with this desire to like make some difference. Like, what am I doing on this rock hurtling through space if it's not to have some difference? And I've seen people make sense of that in so many ways. And I will tell you, as somebody who's been impacted by others, sometimes really significant impact happens from a quick hand squeeze and somebody looking you in the eyes and making you feel seen on the right day. And that can have significant impact that you wouldn't even understand later. And so I think that is wonderful advice for folks who are trying to make a difference in the world. Hear what Jess just told you, because it's exactly right. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's really fun.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing. Mark, anything lingering on the table we want to make sure Jess gets for us?
There's going to be so many people walking their carts back to the store now.
I'm going to be
grocery store employees. We hope we've changed your life in fundamental. See, you never knew that little thing is now going to change everything locally.
That's right. I'm curious, Jess, what kind of hotel guest are you?
Ooh, good one.
That's a fantastic question. Mm. Oh, I'm a total do not disturb me kind of guest. I absolutely will never bypass the front desk. I love that experience, even though, you know, now with technology, you can go to your room without sight unseen. Yeah, I have to see the people.
Tell me what your favorite food is. Where should I go? Like, you don't get that from your app.
Correct. That's where you get it. But after that, no, I don't need my room serviced or cleaned. I like my privacy, and that's a fantastic question.
Do you unpack your bag?
Oh, I 100% unpack my bag.
How long does it take you?
not very long. I use the
hangers. I mean, like you walk in and you hang it?
Oh, yeah, immediately. So yeah. I'm going to be really honest with you.
That's how long it takes you is no time at all.
Yeah, when you get in there, you definitely need to find the luggage cart, yeah. Okay? Don't ever put your luggage on the floor. So either put it on the cart or in the bathtub are the two cleanest places to put your luggage. Don't ever put it on the bed. And then from there, I do a bed bug check. So before I touch anything, you go over, remove the pillows off to the side and start at the headboard and pull back all the layers of the bedding, and you're looking in the
seam. But you must know how to make it tight again when you're done. I lose that whole hotel bed experience when I untuck and look for bed bugs. You got a built-in housekeeper skill set, yeah. Chris Corners. I'm not going to get that experience
when
I check for bed
bugs. Those bugs are well
worth
it, right?
Yeah. No, okay. All right. Well, you've changed my brain forever in a way I can't look back from. Thank you. Loose sheets, here I come. All right, you pull it back. Go on.
Yep. You're checking the seam for any what would be blood spots in there. They'd usually be up in the area, so you're pretty good. You wouldn't see them in the light. And then from there, if there's any kind of dishes in the room that come in, a lot of hotels will have the glasses with a little plastic cover over them. I will wash those before I use them, just because a lot of times they don't get changed out in some of the other properties and stuff. So some travel tricks there.
Thank you.
Yes.
I also immediately unpack. It could be one night. Yeah. I could be there one night and I am unpacking my bag. Is that weird?
I never unpack.
My husband doesn't either.
Yeah, exactly.
What about your wife?
Living out of a bag.
She unpacks?
Yeah, she doesn't either. No. Nope.
3 nights, 1 night, 6 nights, doesn't matter.
We do at least 6 trips a year where it's 2 nights
and
3 days. And we bring one bag.
Like
it's,
you
it's
share
a huge
one bag?
Specialized cycling bag that I got.
No.
That's impressive.
Your stuff does not go in my bag, sir.
When I worked for the Dempsey Challenge, we got these incredible specialized cycling bags. So we both put all of our stuff in there, and we have a bag for food, and we have a cooler. That's how we travel.
I need to get one of those.
We're pretty
Dempsey
efficient.
Challenge. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm efficient. I'm a camper, so I'm real good at packing because it's my stuff. You and your non-rolling, wrinkle-welcoming style of packing needs to go in your own bag.
Well, get ready, because a lot of the brands are moving towards exactly that. A lot of them are eliminating the drawers in hotels because they're finding people aren't using the drawers. Yeah. So, and open-style closets, so no doors on closets. So you're going to start seeing that trend coming out real soon.
What are we going to do, Jess?
That's my question, too, because I'm going to need a Dempsey Challenge bag now.
You're going to need to come back and give us the tips of how to deal with that. I'm not going to be able to cope. Thank you for your time. We so appreciate it.
Thank you for all your work you guys are doing.
Yeah. I hope all of you continue to build, lead, and thrive.